This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. If you want to see the call-in numbers, if you're listening live, you can go to freeenergynow.net. You'll also find a lineup of future interviewees, as well as the past guests that we've had on this show. And our guest today is Ken Riley of Phoenix Navigations and Guidance Incorporated. He's up in Canada. The Phoenix is not to be confused with Phoenix, Arizona. He uses the name of Phoenix as his Phoenix out of the ashes. In this case, the technology is the Tesla turbine, which was invented nearly 100 years ago by Nikola Tesla. And Ken Riley and his crew have been basically bringing that thing to life, making some kind of taking added steps that Nikola Tesla was not able to get to in his lifetime. And in order to introduce that technology, nowadays he's actually looking at the hybrid electric vehicle industry as a way to introduce that technology in an area where they're already amenable to new technology, new approaches. Ken, thanks for joining us.
That's good to be here, Sterling.
Well, Ken, you've been at this for quite a while now in this endeavor. Maybe you can tell us kind of what got you started.
Sure. Well, basically, people want to know who I am, what I do. I'm basically an environmental scientist. I'm the CEO of P&G Inc., and I'm also the chairman of the Global Motive Power Revolution. And what got us started on all of this was some years back, we started reading books like Al Gore's first really good environmental book called Earth in the Balance. And it was a really good dissertation back in about 1992 about the coming crises in the environment that we're now starting to recognize as being a result of our pollution as mankind, and it's our responsibility to do something about this. So actually, the Tesla turbine is something I studied way back when I was going to college at Michigan State University. I came across some old books about old inventors, and Nikola Tesla was one of these inventors that I studied way back then. And this is a technology that we started looking at about 1996 as a possible engine we could use in UAV systems and small aircraft for personal use. And what we started to see is that not only was it a good, robust engine for replacing the piston engine, but it would also do a whole lot towards reducing the pollution and the ill effects of the bad air quality we're really locked into today. So what we're really looking at with the disk turbine is eventually replacing all piston engines across the globe, and we know that this isn't going to happen in the very near future, but as we as a people of the planet realize that we're really screwing up our environment, people are going to become more alarmed, and they're going to start looking around for alternatives to piston engines, and that's when I think turbines are going to really start taking the lead in this century.
And today, if I could inject something here, directory, we have an extensive listing of engine technologies on various engine modalities, very ingenious systems. Many of those are of the order of improvement that you're talking about, you know, 50-fold, even sometimes two or three times as efficient in using the input fuel to get output torque. I'm just curious, you know, at some point in this interview, I would like to hear your input as to how the Tesla turbine stacks up against the other engine technologies that you've come across. Because just because
sure,
you know, Tesla turbine isn't the only one that's trying to break into a long dominated piston engine industry.
No, there are other technologies that look pretty good. One of them, no pun intended here, is a Stirling engine. I'm sure you're not part of that, but the Stirling engine is what a lot of people have been looking at as again, another good replacement to the internal combustion engine. But what we're looking for, ultimately, is something which is much simpler. It has much greater life because of another factor we have to look at is the high cost of industry. If we have to remanufacture cars, trucks, engines over and over again, we're using a tremendous amount of energy to, in effect, melt all these metals back down and reform them into new metals. So part of any kind of initiative that you want to look at environmentally, you have to look at, will the engine last forever? And the Tesla turbine will basically last forever with a simple replacement of bearings. There's nothing to wear out on it. There's one main moving part. The discs don't ever wear out. There's no friction. So we're looking at an engine that'll last not just a lifetime, but an entire eternity of lifetimes. So that's what we see as being probably a superior approach to really getting to the end result of reducing emissions, reducing the high cost of manufacturing and industry. And that's the main approach that... Go ahead.
One of the things that really came to my awareness when you and I first spoke about 3 years ago was just because a system might be superior, some new engine idea, doesn't mean that Detroit is just going to jump all over and immediately adopt it. There are tooling up costs. You talked about melting down old components to build new components, but the infrastructure involved in the automobile industry, where you've got these huge manufacturing facilities with the robotics and whatnot, how much of a factor is that in changing from one modality to a fairly different system?
Well, now we're going to get into one of these no-holds-barred areas that we discussed a little earlier. And we're just going to throw the gauntlet down and just say that the auto industry, whether it's here in Detroit or it's Toyota or Honda, let's just look at the auto industry on a global level. These people are basically concerned about only one thing, and that's digging into your pockets and getting a hold of your money. They have absolutely no concern for the environment. They don't care about our health. They don't care about our welfare. When I say us, I'm talking about the masses. We're the grassroots. We own the world. The grassroots of the world own the world. The rich people, the politicians, these are not the people that run and own the world. We do as a people. And they're supposed to be here to serve us and our best interests as the masses who occupy the planet. But that is in fact not happening. We're dictated to as far as what we're going to buy, what we're going to spend our money on, how much we're going to pay. We have no voice in this world. We have no voice in Washington. We elect people to represent us in Washington, and they do the exact opposite of what we send them there for. A good example is, okay, we overthrew the Republicans in the last election back in November. We sent mostly Democrats there to do one thing, get this country out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan, out of all of these wars for oil, which is what they are. These are just wars for oil. And instead of doing that, they're talking about, well, maybe we'll get them out in another year, maybe 2 years, Bush says, oh, we'll get them out in 20 years. No. If they're not going to go there and start immediately doing what they're sent there to do, aren't we underrepresented as a people? Are we wasting our time even electing these people and sending them to Washington? Well, the same is true of the auto industry or any industry. They don't serve us. We serve them. We serve them by buying products that they dictate to us what they are, how they're going to operate, and then they brainwash us into thinking we're buying a good product, when in fact we're destroying our own health by using them.
Let's get a bit of a context here as to where you're coming from in saying such things. It's not like you're just a consumer of these goods. You actually live somewhat near Detroit, and you've been in the offices and tried to talk to a few people. Give us a snapshot glimpse of your rubbing shoulders with the automobile industry. How many industries have you talked to? I mean, how many of the auto manufacturers have you talked to, and to what extent?
Okay, we'll go back a little further to when I was basically born in Detroit, in East Detroit. I grew up in Dearborn for about 5 years, Dearborn. Our family moved to Grosse Pointe. Now, if you know anything about the Detroit area, Grosse Pointe is where all of the old money is. All of the people that were anything in the car industry, the Fords, the Dodges, everybody who started up and ran the auto industry and really all the industries in Detroit, all the rich people live in either Grosse Pointe or Birmingham. But all the old money is in Grosse Pointe. So I went to school with all of these people, all these, you know, like the Bill Fords and people like that. I went to the same school that they went to. I know these people. I know how they think. I know how they operate. There's no guessing as far as what I'm dealing with. Now, recently, the most recent contact we had was with Ford Motor Company. And we've spoken directly to the people in the drivetrain division there and all the way up to the vice president of the drivetrain division. Basically, what they're telling us as far as new engines or new drivetrains is they're saying, well, we think you people out there are nothing but a pig in a poke. That's what they told us. You're a pig in a poke. Here it is. We're coming up with, and we're not the only ones there. There were some really smart people that are running car development programs on the high school level, developing diesel-powered cars that blow away anything the automakers are coming up with. What it really gets down to is the auto companies hire dime a dozen engineers who don't really know anything about car design, and even if they do, the people at the top don't allow them to really flex their intellect or their experimentation to a point where it's going to change the processes that they're already entrenched in. It's not the job, as far as they're concerned, to do R&D, to come up with a better product. They said, in no uncertain terms, the only way they're going to change is if the customer demands change or if government demands change out of them. Outside of that, there will be no changes coming from Detroit. Now, that's the reason Toyota and Honda and the Europeans are suddenly taking huge amounts of market share. Just this year, GM lost like 20% of its market. Ford lost 30% of its market just in 1 month. That's 30% and 20% of its total market share in 1 month, just in January. Now, how long is an industry here going to continue hemorrhaging jobs, hemorrhaging cash to the Japanese and the Europeans who aren't smarter than we are? They're just a little smarter about getting to the customer. They understand the customer. Now, what we're dealing with is people who run these corporations who are extremely arrogant. They live in a world outside of us. We live at the grassroots. We're not rich people. We live in a grassroots situation along with everybody else. We have to pay our bills. We have to pay our way. Now, they don't have to. They haven't worked a day in their lives. The sons and the daughters of the rich have never worked a day in their lives. They just fool around pushing pencils on papers, putting stamps on papers. They don't work. they don't understand that you have to pay bills, and sometimes you have to decide if you're going to pay food or you're going to pay the gas bill to get to work. They just don't understand that because they're not in the same world we're in. So therefore, the people who run the companies, these are the boards. The boards run the companies, really don't have a clue as to how to market to us. They don't live in our world. They don't understand us. To give you an idea of what's going on at Ford, about half a year ago, up to half a year ago, starting 1 year ago, Bill Ford, who was the CEO and the president of the company at that time, was starting an initiative in Ford to rebuild Ford into the innovative, like he said, into the innovative company that his great-grandfather originally formed, Henry Ford I. And he said what he expected was from everybody in that company, from the lowest person on the totem pole up to the highest, to come up with innovative ways to re-engineer Ford. Well, once he started publishing that train of thought in AI Magazine, Auto Industries Magazine, and a couple other magazines, and he was on TV saying the same thing, within 1 month, the board kicked him out of the presidency. They fired him. He's still the CEO, but he's no longer the guy who runs the everyday operations because they didn't like him talking about innovation and spending money on R&D and change and really starting to give us the products that we need, which are way behind, way overdue. We're way behind the Japanese technologically. We're way behind the Europeans, and we shouldn't be. If you look at the... Go ahead.
If we could steer this toward the Tesla turbine and what that has to offer in terms of the technology and why it's a superior engine technology, that'd be great.
Well, as of this date, I can't really say that the Tesla turbine is at this point a superior engine. And the reason for that is we haven't had the money that's gone into the development of the Tesla turbine or a disk turbine of any type. We haven't gotten the trillions of dollars that the auto industry has spent on the piston engine. It's really just individual people like us, individual small companies that are doing the development, and we don't have the R&D capital to really turn it into a well-proven, perfected technology. It takes us much longer to achieve minor milestones because we just don't have the influx of capital and resources that the other automakers have. So
well,
I can't say that.
There are some prototypes around, both you and your group as well as some others that I've seen. There was one that was demonstrated at the Tesla Tech Conference here in Salt Lake City last year, and these prototypes do show some pretty good data. And there are other engine designs that I mentioned to you earlier, that there's a whole slew of alternative engine designs that are coming out that have been in development that show some really good data. But one of the points you were making to me last night is that it's not good enough just to have some good data from, say, 5 hours or 50 hours of running. What Detroit wants is, 500,000 hours of flawless performance before they're ready to put these things in their car. And to get to that point, you need to have a lot more money to get the research and development and engineering that's required to get to that point. Is that a pretty good recapitulation of what you said?
That's where we sit right now. We have tried many times to approach all of the automakers. Every last major automaker, even minor ones, we've had zero positive response back from them, and it's for the point that you just mentioned. They don't want to put money into something which is not tried and proven over many years of flawless operations. So we're in a catch-22 situation. They won't put money into a program like ours unless they see flawless results, but once we have the flawless results, we don't need them anymore. We already have the engine perfected, so that's where we sit. Now, to go over some of the initiatives that that we're personally doing, we have a club. It's the Phoenix Turbine Builders Club. We have over 1,000 members in the club right now, and these are people from around the world. They're very enthusiastic about disk turbines, and they do. Some of the members are there just to learn. They go to our forum and they learn from people on the forum what's going on. But others are very active participants in experimentation. What we're doing this year, we're covering gas turbine basics, which is pretty much traditional at this point. It's conventional gas turbine basics. And what we intend to do is, once we establish what the basics are, how you derive energy from hot gas flow, that's going to go into developing the disk turbine next year into a fully operational hot gas turbine. So that's where we're at right now with the development. It takes us about 2 years to do a job we could do in a couple of months with more funding, but, you know, that's just the way it is. If you don't have people backing your initiative, either you walk away from it or you do yourself over a longer period of time. At this point, we won't have fully functional Tesla or disk turbines available for people to put into their cars for another 5 to 10 years, simply because we need that time to prove out the reliability of the engine. You need at least 2 to 3 years running before anybody's going to believe that it's reliable.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a minute about what a Tesla turbine is and how it works.
Well, basically, it's a disk turbine. Tesla didn't invent it. It was invented actually earlier in the 19th century, about 1832, I believe. And this is something that he studied in Europe when he was going to the engineering colleges over there. The fact is that he took it from just an experimental phase to a real working steam mode phase. In about 1906, he had the first, I believe it was a 6-inch turbine build up, and it operated really well. He worked through a couple other sizes. He went to a 12-inch, then down to a 10-inch, and found the 10-inch disk turbine, 10-inch in diameter on the rotor. It was about ideal for 110 horsepower. Now, basically, it's just a stack of round disks that are spaced about a 32nd of an inch apart, and fluid of some type. It could be hot gas, it could be steam, or it could be compressed air, is entered into the periphery, around the periphery, the outer periphery of these disks at a 90-degree tangent, and the gas goes between the plates, and through an adhesion effect, it pulls the disks along with the high-speed gas, and as the gas spirals down towards the center where the exit is, and it's delivering or transferring energy from the kinetic gas to the rotor, and you know, that goes out as horsepower on the shaft. But it's what you call a boundary layer effect. The gas doesn't even really touch the disks. It interacts with the boundary layer, which is attached to the disks, sort of like an airplane effect, wing effect.
You give the example of the opposite phenomena using a golf ball with the dimples?
Mm-hmm. Now, the golf ball with the dimples actually create a vortex. It's a vortex effect which breaks the adhesion, and that's what gives
turbulence.
It creates a turbulence in the dimples. That breaks the adhesion between the ball and the surrounding air, which makes it more slippery as it goes through the air. Well, in a disk turbine, you don't want slip between the incoming air and the disks. You want as much adhesion as you possibly can, so the disks are polished very, very smoothly to get as much adhesion between the supersonic gas and the boundary layer, which is attached to the disks. You want adhesion rather than slip.
Right. On your website, I pulled off a little graph that shows the compares different types of engines and their efficiencies of converting fuel into usable energy torque. The bladed turbine is at 22%, a gas piston engine at 32%, a diesel engine at 42%, a fuel cell at 50%. Then you peg the Tesla turbine at 60%. Is that theoretical or experimental? Has that been proven? Did Tesla actually prove that, or how close did he get?
Tesla actually did build up a pulse detonation gas turbine, and his empirical results gave him 60% efficiency. Now, what he did mention at the time, and this is where you have to really read between the lines with anything that Tesla writes, is he said that even though he achieved 60%, he was not able to get any usable horsepower out of the engine because it needed a compressor stage. Now, we all know that once you start putting a compressor on, that robs horsepower from your total energy system. So that would drive your 60% efficiency down to a much lower number depending on how much compression you actually use. Now, other studies that we've made, we've done a very thorough study about the conventional turbines to figure out why they're so inefficient. And basically, you have an engine which requires an enormous amount of cooling air and an enormous amount of compression to make it work. A conventional turbine operates at about 450 psi, so the normal axial compressor, which is, it could be 9 or 12 stages of compression to get it up to 450 psi, you're using a whole lot of energy to compress that air. Some of that air goes into combustion. Some of that air has to pass through the system to carry the enormous heat energy away, or that engine would burn up in seconds if you didn't have cooling air. And now, what's really bad about conventional turbines is they use up to two-thirds of their total horsepower just in compressing air for combustion and cooling because of the dynamics of the engine. Now, some of the experiments that we've carried out here where we're getting into what you call pulse detonation, where you're detonating air and fuel, that's a phenomenon all by itself where you're achieving very high gas velocity, not through compressing air, but through detonating fuel and air in a chamber. And what we found is you can start out with very, very low compressed air on the order of just an atmosphere or two atmospheres, and you get a very high rate of gas, which is what the Tesla turbine is looking for. The Tesla turbine is looking for supersonic gas to work from. The faster you make the gas, which is combusted fuel and air, the faster you make it go, the more efficiency you get out of a disk turbine. Now, you can't use pulse detonation in a conventional turbine because of the oscillating effect of the pulse detonation would literally fatigue the blades off of the turbine. It would just the heat and the oscillation would just destroy the blades in no amount of time at all. With the disk turbine, since you don't have blades or conventional blades as such, you don't have that problem with oscillations destroying your engine. It'll absorb oscillating gas from now till eternity and hold together. And what we're projecting then is instead of putting, say, two-thirds of your horsepower into compressing air for your combustion, you could get away with 10, 15, 20% of your horsepower rather than 60% of your horsepower. So that's where we're looking at numbers that are at least as good as diesel, but we're projecting even better. We're projecting the overall efficiencies of a pulse detonation disk turbine to be between 45 and 50%.
So this chart, excuse me, that's on your website, may be a little bit outdated in terms of the new information that you just provided. That puts it right close to where the fuel cells are at, which is 50%.
We'll be right in line with fuel cell efficiencies, but with a big advantage. If we can talk a couple minutes about fuel cells. Now, fuel cells, around here we call them not fuel cells, we call them fuel cells, and for a reason. The fuel cell is a very immature technology which is not right around the corner, like Bush is saying. It's not coming out of Detroit in the next couple of years. This is very, very premature technology which will not be ready until the 22nd century for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons is that the power density is really poor. The expense is really high. They generate a lot of heat that has to be dealt with. You have to have radiators to keep them cool, just like an internal combustion engine. And there's no infrastructure to provide us with the hydrogen that they ultimately need, rather than methanol or gasoline like GM's proposing. Whenever you use methanol or gasoline, you have contaminants in the fuel. Eventually, that contaminates the PEM plastic cell between the oxygen and the hydrogen side, and it wears out in about 30,000 miles. So every 30,000 miles, you have a $30,000 bill replacing a fuel cell which is barely able to make that car go. The power density is just all off. Now, I believe that eventually they'll get it. They'll get the technology developed. But it's like batteries. People think there's a magic battery out there. There's no magic battery. There's no magic fuel cell. All of this will come into its own in, say, 90 or 100 years. It's really for the 22nd century. The turbine is for the 21st century, which we're in right now. Turbines are ready to go, but a new type of turbine.
When you say ready to go, you're saying 5 to 10 years before you have a fully functional, industry-ready turbine?
Well, it could be less. It could be 18 months, like I said, with proper funding, but we don't have that funding, so we either have to give up on it or we have to say we'll do it in the 5 to 10. Our approach is, the hell with the auto companies, let's just do it. We'll do it in our 5 to 10. We're in this for the long run.
And you, when you say you, in this case, there's 1,000 people in this Phoenix Builders Club who are
right.
Basically open sourcing this, comparing notes, developing, testing,
right.
And sharing what they know, and kind of growing together. So you have this common brain trust that is, taking you replace the money of the automobile industry with just a wide groundswell of grassroots involvement, and whether or not they get involved, you're going to be moving forward the best you can, and I think that's commendable.
Well, that brings us to another point. Right from the start, right around 2000, 2001, if you study into some of our white papers on the global motive power revolution, we always talked about hybrid vehicles as being the direction we had to take everything in. We could see the handwriting on the wall right then. What we're doing this year is really it's like a two-pronged approach. We're pushing the development on the turbine, not real hard, not real fast, but in the right direction, which is pulse detonation, which is where your high efficiencies are really going to be. And like I said, that's going to take a couple years just to get something operational, but it is moving forward. Now, the other thing that we're really driving hard on right now is developing low-cost hybrid electric and hybrid hydraulic drivetrains for hybrid vehicles. And like we discussed last night a little bit, we're not happy with any hybrid vehicle that's coming out on the market, whether it's from Japan or from the United States, which are, your two main areas which are developing and starting to market hybrids. Europe isn't really interested. That's a real interesting point. Toyota's hybrids and Honda's hybrids are not selling in Europe. Do you know why?
Why is that?
Uh, the Toyotas and the Honda hybrids are not as efficient as their small diesel-powered cars that they're running in Germany and France and Italy and places like that. They're getting better fuel economy with their small, pretty small diesel-powered cars. It's like we were discussing. We were driving diesel-powered rabbits here a decade ago. They were giving us over 55 miles per gallon. Well, that's, and that was no matter what speed you're going, you're getting 55 miles per gallon, basically. That's better than a Toyota or a Honda can do with real numbers. I'm not talking about their trumped-up numbers like we discussed. A lot of those numbers are put out by car companies that have the car going downhill with tailwind. And that's how they get those high numbers. But EPA is calling them on the carpet, and they're saying, no, we want you to give us the numbers with things running like air conditioners and things that people normally use, and they're really balking at it. They're saying, well, that's not fair. We can't get the numbers you're looking for. You know, a Toyota is really just maybe 42, 46 miles per gallon when you operate it under normal conditions. That's not really high.
Mm-hmm. I should mention for our listeners that earlier this week we linked to a story of ZP Energy, which is a report by Peter Lindemann of how to build a 100-mile-per-gallon car. You just take a low-weight vehicle and you put a small diesel engine in it, and then you put an efficient transmission in there, and voila, you're getting 100 miles per gallon. And so uh-huh. What you're saying is, over in Europe, their diesel engines and their small vehicles are getting superior economy to what Toyota and Honda are selling to the United States by way of hybrid electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Exactly. That's why... Go ahead.
So where you're coming from, you've got a two-pronged approach. One is to keep working on the Tesla turbine on the one hand. On mm-hmm. the other hand, to break into the hybrid electric approach. And what is your approach there in the hybrid vehicle technology?
Okay, we saw or we rediscovered a couple of old articles we had in our files that we ripped out from Mother Earth News magazines. These date back to about 1978, 79, that period. And what we saw was a couple of hybrid vehicles that were being experimented with. One was a hybrid hydraulic system that was out of Minnesota. A professor up in Minnesota has been working on that, Ernie Parker. And then there was another electrical engineer that did a hybrid electric vehicle. Now, what's really strange is that both of these guys were getting like 70 miles per gallon back in the late 70s. And basically what both of them did was they downscaled the size of the engine down to about 10 to 15 horsepower. That's the range that they operate in. And that's the key to the hybrid vehicle, is to get the horsepower down, not push it up. Now, because of the marketing, that market feedback that Toyota and other car companies are getting, people want performance. They want performance even more than they want miles per gallon. So Toyota's moving in the wrong direction. They started out with about I believe it was 1.8-liter engine. They're up to 2.5 or 2.8 and climbing, just because people want more performance. But with performance, using their parallel approach, which is it'd take hours to talk about parallel approach. Anyway, using the mechanisms that they have, which is using the internal combustion engine with an electric booster of sorts, they're getting the kind of performance people want, but as they keep pushing the size of the engine up, the economy starts going down through the basement. Now, what these other really successful people have done with their hybrid designs to get 70 to 100 miles per gallon, which is what the electrical engineer finally came up with, about 100 miles per gallon, they stayed with small engines. That's the key to the whole thing. Now, what we're trying to do with people is to get people to wake up to the fact that you can get a very good operational vehicle with those tried and proven designs. You don't have to have, all of us, we don't have to have tire burners in order to get around, save fuel costs, save our health by cleaning the air and getting us off of foreign oil. I believe that we all, as grassroots people, have to take personal responsibility to do our part. Now, whether that sounds like communism or not, I don't care. We're not communists. We're just saying that all of us have to take personal responsibility, like we're saying we're not being represented in Washington or in industry. They're not designing, developing, and selling to us good products at a very low price. So our approach right now is to fully develop a system by the end of the summer which will bring hybrid vehicle technology to the masses at a very low cost. Now, the way we're going to do that is through, first of all, we're going to start up a new car company, not to build cars, but to retrofit people's existing cars. People have very good cars right now. They just have bad engines and bad drivetrains attached to them. The engine is the bogus of the whole thing. The engine's got to go. Now, basically, what you do to retrofit...
Engines are pretty expensive, and to replace an engine is not going to be a small cost either for the component as well as the labor.
No, what we're the basis of our program is to have people pretty much do this on a do-it-yourself basis. In effect, create a network, first a national, then a global network of builders clubs, sort of like we're doing with the Tesla or the Phoenix Turbine Builders Club. We've learned through that you can get people to participate in club activities. And instead of doing things like politicians are saying, putting either a cap on carbon or the worst thing you could possibly imagine is they want to start taxing us, you know, the regular people, the regular Joes out here. They want to tax us because they say we're all using too much fuel. So these jerks are proposing that we don't have enough expenses to pay in food and fuel as it is, so they want to tax us in order to hurt us and get us to stop using so much fuel. What we're saying is instead of beating people with a stick, why don't you give them something interesting to do, like make it enjoyable, make it fun to cut emissions. Al Gore says... in his movie, have you seen An Inconvenient Truth?
Yeah.
Okay, so in his movie, he says we all have to cut emissions 50% in order to get a hold of this disaster that we're all participating in and creating. Well, okay, he's got half of the solution. We have the other half, which is we have a design right now that we've figured out, which will do exactly what he's proposing, but not by beating people into subjection with more taxation, but by providing people with the components to retrofit their third vehicle. Basically, households need two vehicles to get two people working back. But take the third vehicle or go get a third vehicle, put it in the garage, and on a hobby basis, convert that third vehicle into a very highly efficient hybrid electric vehicle using your components.
And one of the things we've not talked about yet I'm curious about with this system that you have is the hydraulics. You mentioned it briefly earlier as a method of actually giving you that low speed, high punch that some people like to have and that is maybe necessary at times when you want to turn into traffic and you want to, you know, be able to merge into a situation. You need to be able to have that kick. And you have a way of giving that kick through hydraulics. Could we talk about that for a minute? And then the associated question is, does your kit approach incorporate that hydraulic system?
Okay, what we're doing with the hybrid approach is it's actually, like we mentioned a little earlier, we're taking both an HEV and an HHV approach, which is hybrid electric and hybrid hydraulic. Now, the really interesting thing about both hydraulics and electrics is that they have the same, they're identical in that they're both fluids. You have hydraulic fluid which flows, you have electric fluid which flows, and strangely enough, both engine types, if you want to call it that, or both drivetrain types have exactly the same characteristics, which is low end, real high low end torque. Both electric motors and hydraulic motors have very, very high low end torque. Low end torque is like when you're standing still and you want to suddenly accelerate and you want to brake from standstill to accelerated mode, you need a lot of torque. Now, the internal combustion engine, or the piston engine, does not have low-end torque. It develops its torque at about 2,000 to 3,000, sometimes 4,000 RPMs, but it has very, very poor low-end torque. Both electrics and hydraulics have very high low-end torque. In fact, with the electrics, an electric motor will continue to draw as much amperage as it needs to develop as much torque as is necessary to accelerate you at any speed. Hydraulics is basically the same. Like we said, the two mediums are really identical in nature. They're just two different forms of the same thing. Now, with the kit approach that we're, or kit and component approach that we're going to get into by the end of this year with people, we're going to start out with hybrid electrics, supplying electric components. The hydraulic systems will be developed probably in 2008, and that'll be a follow-up drivetrain. We're really not sure yet as far as the longevity of hydraulics parts, so we can't really say when that's going to be available. We know that they do work. We don't know how long they last. Electrics have been proven for really decades to just last practically forever if you don't overheat them. I don't know if you're aware that there's a very strong electric vehicle movement in this country. Electric movement is pure electrics. That's where you have a very large, very heavy battery pack around 1,100, 1,200 pounds of batteries, and you control that power to an electric motor, but there's no regenerating system on board like a hybrid.
And yours would be regenerative?
Yeah, what we would have available for people is we would have basically in a very stripped-down kit, you would have to have a generator, a motor, and a controller. And those would be your basic components. Now, people can scrounge their own engines. We're looking at all kinds of engines that could power these systems up. It could be a lawnmower engine. It could be an outboard engine. It could be just like a utility garden tractor engine. Anything that'll spin this generator up will give you the power that you need to make the system work. And that's a very expensive part of the package if you're going to include all the parts and you're going to have an internal combustion engine in there. That's a very expensive part of the whole thing. But there are people who want that. Like we were discussing, there are people who would like to keep their BMWs and their Mercedes. They'd like to drive them, but they want them politically correct, you could say. So what we'd also offer is to do conversions for people who want the BMW converted to a hybrid so they can do their part, like everybody else, to cut emissions.
And the purpose of the engine in that setup would be to provide ongoing charging of the batteries. It's not to provide direct torque, but it would...
Let's take a little bit of a comparison look between, say, Toyota and GM and Ford. Their approach is to provide torque through the internal combustion engine, through a mechanical drivetrain. Now, they also have a generator a flywheel generator which charges up their lithium-ion batteries, and that provides boost power for acceleration or climbing up hills. So their generator only charges up their batteries for intermittent use on the electric motor. With our system, which is actually different from the Mother Earth News design, we have a matched generator and motor. They're the same amperage. We have a 400-amp generator, a 400-amp motor, and these two components work one-on-one, one-to-one ratio. When you don't need all of that power, say if you're at lower speeds, then some of the generator power is going into the batteries and stored up as acceleration power. Now, when you need to accelerate very quickly or you need to go up a hill, some of that power from the batteries is then also routed to the motor, so you have a very high amperage for a very short amount of time for times when you need that jackrabbit start, for instance. So most of the time, you do have the generator directly running the motor. It's only when you need that really fast, hot performance that you get a huge draw from the battery pack. And since we don't need that power all the time, our battery packs are relatively small and lightweight compared to other systems. The key to the whole thing is in power management.
What about, before we get into power management, what about range? If you're doing a cross-country trek, would you have to stop and wait for a few hours to recharge a system, or could you go continuously?
Okay, that's an interesting point. If you have an electric vehicle, which a lot of people in the country have done conversions for, you would have to stop and recharge. With a hybrid vehicle, you don't have to stop and charge. It'll charge as you go. With the Mother Earth News design, they had a range of around 80 miles before their system had to, in effect, either go into low-speed mode or they had to stop and charge because their generator was not large enough. It wasn't sufficiently large to directly drive the motor at freeway speeds. With our system, since this is a matched pair at a very high amperage, the generator drives the motor directly for an indefinite amount of time, so you can run at highway speeds all day long as you have fuel.
Okay. So that's one of the primary things that our consumer market in the United States would want, is the ability to go on a long trip if necessary.
Uh-huh.
And yours would provide that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you have indefinite or infinite range as long as you can put in gasoline, or our systems will be, you'll be able to convert to methanol or ethanol, some of the biofuels, if you want to run it really cleanly. But yeah, you can use just standard gasoline.
We're coming up about 2 minutes left on our interview here. You have not talked about power management, and that's a key component of your system. If you could address that briefly, and then let's wrap her up with, give your website and things like that.
Okay, when we talk about power management, we have to look at what we call a BEP, or best efficiency point, for each of the components in your system. Your electric motors have a certain RPM BEP. Your generators also have a certain RPM best efficiency point, and your gasoline engine has its best efficiency point. All of these have to be matched perfectly to get the best efficiency and use the least amount of fuel and create the least amount of emissions. That's our approach to starting from the ground up and designing everything with all the BEPs in line. And that means you have to manage your power through electronics. And electronics is really the key to the whole thing, and that's where we really specialize, is in power management.
Okay. So ideally, in these kits, each one would need to have some engineering input as to which components to use for that automobile setup. Give us your website address.
Okay, you can You can go to www.phoenixnavigation.com. That's all one word, Phoenix Navigation, Phoenix Navigation. And from there you can go to either the Turbine Builders Club if you want to see what we're doing there. You can go to the Global Motive Power Revolution where we get into the politics of what's really ailing the country. And it's a no-holds-barred area. It's a fun area. We're just having a lot of fun with politics, economics, industry, and we're coming up with some really fun solutions for people who really want a way out of this. It seems like a nightmare of not being able to get out of their economic situations. We're giving people a way out.
Well, Ken, I really appreciate you coming and joining us on this show today to talk about the Tesla Turbine and some interim technologies, some hybrid technologies to keep us occupied while we wait before the Tesla Turbine's developed far enough for us to implement in next-generation vehicles, which you see as being the engine of the 21st century. It's been
That's
a fascinating
what I believe.
Interview. Yeah. Do you have any final points to make before we wrap this up?
Just one point I want to make is we agree completely with Al Gore and his approach to cutting emissions to save the planet. We believe that it's every one of our personal responsibility. All of us have to take personal responsibility to reduce the cost of fuel and save fuel costs, to cut our emissions by 50%, to really get a hold of our health again. If you lose your air, you lose your health, so we've got to reclaim our air again, air quality, and get us off of foreign oil. And we're giving people a real pathway to that, that end goal of being able to get to that point of using less fuel, putting out a lot fewer emissions, and let's get off of foreign oil. And I believe we're probably the only people in the country who have a real solution. The obviously industry and the automakers are not giving us a cost-effective or affordable solution, and we're going to change that.
Well, thank you, Ken. This has been Sterling Allen, your host, with Free Energy Now. Join us every day at freeenergynews.com.